as has been said, my title is Human Rights Versus Religion, and that might seem a bit curious because those of you who are familiar with human rights documents might realise that the right to freedom of religion is written in every one of them, and I'll talk later about just how important many people may think it is. But certainly that people have a right to freedom of religion is thought to be essential. I mean, it's the one thing you can, like the right to life, really, it's the one thing you can be sure you'll find in any human rights document. In this country, I think we're particularly concerned with the European Convention of Human Rights, and there is a very clear absolute right to freedom of religion and belief. Now, it's only a right to believe what you want. When it comes to manifestation, the second part of the clause allowing freedom of religion qualifies the right to manifest it. Because, of course, obviously, if you want to manifest your religion, there are some ways which might be not terribly conducive to morality. If your religion says that you should sacrifice people or eat people, or well, religions can say all kinds of funny things. Obviously, there are some things that religion says that a democratic society could not allow. So that is, I suppose, one reason why we find the right qualified. But I think I'm just to mention that division, I get worried by that division, because if you think about what does the right to freedom of belief, freedom of religious belief particularly mean, if you can't manifest it, it doesn't mean very much. If manifesting it means even talking about it, saying what you believe, then quite clearly a totalitarian regime which wants to suppress religion is quite happy if you believe what you want, as long as you never show it in your behaviour, your actions, your speech. So if everything is a manifestation, then that would suggest that actually the right, the absolute right to freedom of belief, has become very attenuated. Now, this just comes back to a basic issue about human rights, that many people think that human rights are of an absolute nature. They trump other things. That's part of their point. But, of course, once you start talking about rights, it doesn't require very much imagination to realise that they can begin to clash with each other. We can all think of examples. Particular example might be the right to express your religious belief, but that may clash with the right of other people not to be discriminated against. And that's a particularly important clash nowadays, when you might get a clash between religious rights and the rights, say, of homosexuals. So there is, therefore, a very great possibility of clash between rights. And the question is, what do you do about that? And one possibility is that it just, in the end, collapses into a calculation of consequences, and then the whole notion of rights just goes out of the window. Another possibility is that some rights are thought more important than others. There is no hierarchy of rights, many human rights people say, but it may very well be you just quietly forget some rights as not being very important and emphasise others as being important. Now, this all goes back to the basic issue that how are rights important for morality anyway? Because utilitarians, consequentialists generally, might think that the notion of an absolute right, regardless of consequences, is exceptionally dangerous. And we all know that utilitarians traditionally thought that rights embody nonsense on stilts. So the question is anyway, are human rights terribly helpful when we talk about morality? In ordinary life, of course, nowadays, it's very easy to assume that rights are the only thing that matter in morality. I have my rights, we're told, time and time again. It's not very clear what having a right means unless you know who's going to meet that right, who has a responsibility for meeting it. So that, again, is another problem about rights. But the notion of human rights is on everybody's lips. It's part of the currency, the rhetoric of politics. So it's, I think, important to see how it is actually working out. how far it does elucidate and inform our moral views. Just before I came here this afternoon, I was reading an email from the Republic of Ireland where people were grumbling about the Irish Commission of Human Rights, which has just issued a very lengthy 100-page document concerning the position of church schools in the Republic of Ireland. Now, the point about church schools, and of course they're long established, mainly Catholic, the point about those schools is that they're there, presumably, to, if not exactly inculcate religious faith, at least to somehow express it in education. And those who think that human rights are important will say, yes, but what about those who are not Catholic? What about those who don't wish to be suffering indoctrination or proselytism, words that are used in the document but not defined? What do we do about that? No one has a right to be excluded from an institution or to feel somehow second class because they don't uphold its values. So here you see human rights being almost used as a weapon in practice against religion. That you have a traditional institutional setup of Catholic schools and then a doctrine of human rights being introduced that suggests that actually imposing any kind of religious view, and imposing is another word for just teaching, is somehow to be ruled out. Now this, I think, exemplifies a basic attitude in Europe nowadays, where the role of religion in the public sphere is very much contested. There are philosophical arguments being put forward for it, that religion is of its nature irrational, faith and reason are separate. It's seen as subjective, beyond the scope of rational debate. Now, there's a long philosophical argument about faith and reason, and it's almost the most important issue in the philosophy of religion. So I'm not going to get involved too much in that, but just to point out that there is this attitude very prevalent, more prevalent in non-philosophical than philosophical circles. But let me quote from a law case in the England and Wales High Court from the 28th of February this year, where they in fact quote a previous law case of last year where Lord Justice Laws made what I thought were very tendentious statements. Now, the important thing here is that the thing is resonating through the courts, that one judge makes pronouncements that seem highly controversial, they're picked up by the judges and they become, in effect, the law of the land. They say the conferment of any legal protection or preference upon a particularly substantive moral position on the ground that it's espoused only by the adherents of a particular faith is deeply unprincipled. It imposes compulsory law not to advance the general good on objective grounds, but to give effect to the force of subjective opinion. This must be so, because in the eye of everyone save the believer, religious faith is necessarily subjective, being incommunicable by any kind of proof or evidence. The ascertainment of such a truth, if it is true, and paradoxically they do accept it might be, it lies beyond the means by which laws are made in a reasonable society. I think that word reasonable perhaps echoes the work of John Rawls. Therefore, it lies only in the heart of the believer who's alone bound by it. No one else is or can be so bound unless by his own free choice he accepts its claims. The promulgation of law for the protection of a position held on religious grounds cannot be justified. It is irrational. It prefers the subjective over the objective. It's divisive, capricious, and arbitrary. So we have words like subjective, irrational, divisive, capricious, arbitrary being referred to religion. I was once taught by A.J. Eyre in the kind of waning days of logical positivism. I'm sure he would approve very much of that kind of statement, really, in spirit anyway. And it's really assuming, as people like Richard Dawkins do nowadays, that proof or evidence is only scientific proof or evidence. Anything else is beyond the scope of reason. Faith is of its nature subjective. Well, if you believe that, of course, religion can have no place in the public sphere. There are also sociological pressures. There's an undoubted decline in Western Europe in religious belief, so less people bother about these things. There are political reasons, which are echoed in what I've just quoted, that religion is seen as something divisive. It's something to be protecting people from. It's a threat to social cohesion. So the result is that, at least in Europe, diversity and pluralism are extolled, and so is the idea of the neutrality of the state. And this attitude feeds into the Council of Europe, which itself appoints the European Court of Human Rights, and the European Court of Human Rights comes out with all of this as well. The Council of Europe has been adamant that, and I quote from something it said some 3 years ago, but it echoes these remarks late since. But it said then, states must require, I like that word, require, religious leaders to take an unambiguous stand in favour of the precedence of human rights as set forth in the European Convention of Human Rights over any religious principle. The precedence of human rights over any religious principle. In other words, human rights and religion are seen as something totally distinct, and actually, implicitly, religion is seen as a threat to human rights, that human rights have to be protected from religion. Only a month or so back, the Assembly of the Council of Europe maintained that freedom of religion and freedom to have a philosophical or secular worldview are inseparable from unreserved acceptance by all of the fundamental values enshrined in the Convention. In other words, you really can't claim freedom of religion if you don't believe in human rights. Again, I find that a very odd way of setting the scene, because, as I said at the beginning, a human right to freedom of religion is part of what human rights consist of. So to oppose the two seems very artificial. Now, a lot of people, in the United States particularly, would find all of this exceedingly strange. Many Americans of my acquaintance are very keen to stress that religious freedom is the first freedom. Now, those of you who are familiar with the Bill of Rights in the US Constitution will know that, of course, it does appear first in the First Amendment. And therefore, I think the phrase first religion partly picks that up, but it's saying something much more than that, namely, that the drafters of the Bill of Rights, namely people like James Madison, actually meant to emphasize this above all. If you look into the history of Virginia in particular, you will see that people like Madison and Jefferson were adamant that freedom of religion lay at the heart of all democratic freedoms. It was partly a reaction to the very rigid attitude of the Church of England established in Virginia, and incidentally, it was far more rigid than the Church of England was at the time in this country, and far more intolerant of nonconformity. And in a sense, I didn't think it was living up to the English Bill of Rights of 1689, which it should have been, but that's a historical byway. But the point is that they were reacting against an existing situation. They believed you can't be free, really free, if you're not free to put into effect what you think most important in life. And religion, I suppose, is by definition what people think most important. I wouldn't say that everything that people think most important, therefore, is their religion. Now, that's probably going a bit far. You're probably familiar with the old story of the English football manager who was accused of treating soccer as his religion. He said very indignantly, it certainly isn't, it's much more important than that. Certainly, nevertheless, religion for most people is what's most important. And if you can't put that into action, then that means that you're not able to live by what you believe is most important. And therefore, you're not really being able to contribute properly to democratic debate, because what you think is most important for the common good is something that actually you're debarred from bringing forth. So if religion is regarded as subjective and capricious and divisive and therefore not to be brought into the public arena, you're being told you can't deal with your most important judgments about what's right and wrong and conducive to the common good. And therefore, your ability as a citizen to contribute to democratic debate is considerably curtailed. Anyway, that is what Americans believed at the foundation of the United States. And they believed that because they had a very different conception of human rights from the one which I've been referring to. Now, I think the clue to a lot of this, to the difference in emphasis between the French and more general European attitude to rights and the American one, is their historic origins. If you look at the pronouncements of the Council of Europe nowadays, you find that very often the French and perhaps Spanish socialists are the most vociferous in pursuit of the neutrality of the state to religion. And this undoubtedly stems from the values of the later Enlightenment, that the French were in fact seared by their experience of the authoritarianism of the Catholic Church. They regarded reason as emancipation from that, from the stifling hand of tradition and authority. Therefore, reason was almost, in their eyes, of necessity anti-clerical. So reason, to be freed from all of that, had, in a sense, to be opposed to it. So human rights and reason, the twin issues in the Enlightenment that were pressed most, were both meant to be opposed to religion and not stemming from it. And that attitude lives on. Religion is a threat to people's freedom. It's a threat to people's free use of reason. But that was not the view of rights that occurred in the United States. Of course, 1776 wasn't far apart from 1789, the French Revolution, but what fed into each was rather different. Jefferson, one of the great leaders and founders of the movement towards independence in the United States, was profoundly influenced by the writings of John Locke. If you go to Monticello in Virginia, his home, you'll find that he has a portrait of John Locke there, and Locke was one of his trinity of, he thought, the three greatest men who'd ever lived. The other two were Newton and Bacon. But he was profoundly influenced by Locke's views about natural rights. And although Jefferson was by no means an orthodox Christian, I think he was a theist of some kind, and he did believe that rights were grounded in the Creator. Indeed, the Declaration of Independence, of course, says that we have, in fact, been endowed with rights by our Creator. And Locke's views were very much stemming from this basic theism. It's easy to think of Locke as just a British empiricist, Locke, Berkeley, Hume, and in a sense to look at them through the eyes of the later Hume. But Locke wasn't just an empiricist. He was somebody who wrote a book on the reasonableness of Christianity. He had a very profound theological vision. He believed that all humans were equal because they were equal in the sight of God. He believed in freedom because he believed in free will. And his views of reason were of a faculty given humans by God. Now, in this, he was influenced very much by the Cambridge Platonists, who were active in Cambridge in the 17th century at the birth of modern science, who influenced some of the scientists who founded the Royal Society, who themselves, some of their members, were actually members of the Royal Society at the beginning. Locke was very involved with them, nearly married the daughter of one of them, so he really was involved with them. Their motto was reason is the candle of the Lord. Now, the point about that is that their notion of rights, their notion of reason, their notion of freedom is based in a notion of God. In other words, all of that is validated by God. It isn't opposed to God. So it's a very different vision of the relation of rights and religion from that coming from the later Enlightenment in France. And I think this proves, and is shown particularly, in even contemporary debates, even when people don't quite realise where all these views have come from. Now, of course, I'm simplifying, because the idea that rights are opposed to religion would be contested by many people on the continent. Much of American culture wars revolve around how far, in fact, God should still be on the scene, or how far the state should be absolutely neutral. And in some of the pronouncements of the United States Supreme Court, you can see they're moving more towards the position of some of the pronouncements of the European Court of Human Rights. But basically, you have two opposing attitudes: a view of religion as a force for social cohesion on the one hand, a view of human rights as based on religion, and therefore freedom of religion is going to be the first freedom. Because unless we have the freedom to judge what is right, we haven't got a freedom even to see the importance of rights and their grounding. On the other hand, there's a secularist view of religion in France, La Laïcité. That name, incidentally, says a lot, doesn't it? Because it's redolent of anti-clericalism. It carries with it the whiff of the importance of the laity. We're not going to have any kind of priestcraft here. Religion is a threat we must be protected from. In other words, this is all the difference between, in America still, there is a view that there should be freedom for religion. In other words, religion is still thought by many to be a positive force. I mean, it may not be something that you sign up to, but it's certainly something that can be encouraged within the general ambit of a democratic state. It might actually help democracy. De Tocqueville, in the early 19th century, writing about the United States, thought that it was absolutely essential and in forming American character. It explained the American character that was at the root of American democracy. That explained why the United States was as it was. The French model, however, as you said, is contested. There was a case recently, which you may have come across, over the display of crucifixes in Italian schools. Now, first in the European court, it was said that they shouldn't display crucifixes. A lot of these arguments are about symbols, but of course they are obviously standing proxy for something very much deeper about how far religion should be influencing things. What is the place of religion in a school? So is the display of a symbol itself something that is a threat? Is it suggesting we're imposing religious values? Or are religious values something not to be feared? Incidentally, very recently, the Grand Chamber, that's the final court of appeal in the European Court, overturned the original decision and said quite firmly that freedom of religion wasn't the same thing as secularism, and that it was quite in order for a country, if they wished, to display religious symbols. It was probably just as well some Scandinavians were pointing out they'd have to change their flags. In fact, we'd have to change the Union Jack if we weren't allowed to use religious symbols, because there are crosses on all of those. But that was much contested. There are plenty of people in Europe who feel very strongly that there shouldn't be crucifixes. Incidentally, it was interesting that even Italian Protestants saw the crucifix as a sign of Catholic domination. So they were on the side of removing them. But that root is a dispute itself about the origin of human rights. What are they grounded on? Because if they're themselves separate from religion, they can't be grounded in religion. Locke was undoubtedly connecting religion with natural rights. Certainly, Americans following him did. Where do notions of human dignity come from, for instance? What are they grounded on? I find a lot of people who don't want to turn to religion but want to talk about human rights flounder at this point. They tend to say things like, and I think even Dworkin and Rorty tend to say things like this, that, well, rights are what we believe in. I mean, we being, I don't know, East Coast Americans, presumably. And if you're not an East Coast American, why believe in it? There isn't any real rationale there as to why rights matter, what they're grounded in. But they're just part of our culture, which is a very insubstantial way. I mean, or some legal writers say, well, they're just grounded in American law. That's what American law consists in. But, of course, they forget that American law is like that because of the prior theological convictions of the people who drew up the Constitution. So without religion, human rights, I think, can easily float free. And then it's difficult to know how we teach them to children who would say, well, why do they matter? Or even, why do humans matter? And of course, there are plenty of people who don't believe in rights, and there are plenty of people who don't believe that there is such a category as humanity to be protected. I mean, that's another question, because what about animals, etc.? And postmodernists don't believe in the notion of being human either. So there's always, a slight embarrassment on the part of some postmodernists who want to uphold human rights, but don't quite want to admit there's such a thing as being human. I think it's quite possible that a belief in human rights is actually unsustainable without the religious foundations that gave them meaning. Now, this is therefore to challenge the later Enlightenment from the standpoint of the early Enlightenment. Of course, another way is to say, let's junk the whole talk about human rights, which is another possibility. Perhaps it doesn't help our ethical thinking at all. But if one thinks it does, if you think there are certain ways that perhaps humans shouldn't be treated, why do we think that? I've rather indicated that the slogan of the French Revolution, Liberté, Égalité, Fraternité, is itself grounded in Christian thinking, because you just think about it, liberté, freedom. Why does freedom matter now? People like Locke, who believed in the importance of human free will, Cambridge Platonists certainly did, would obviously have a theological justification for respecting people's freedom. Egalité, why is equality important? Why are human beings equal? They don't seem to be sometimes, in many respects. Well, an obvious quick answer is we're all equal in the sight of God. And that's probably the traditional European answer. Why are we equal otherwise? Fraternité, well, I think that obviously the notion of brotherhood makes no sense outside the context of the fatherhood of somebody, obviously God. So all that comes from a Christian background, and I think rather illustrates a point made by Jürgen Habermas, who, whilst himself not a believer, does emphasise the fact that Christian values have helped to form Europe, and without them, Europe will change very much, that the values that sustain our present ways of thinking are no longer being maintained, and that there is therefore a very big question about how far we can go on thinking as we do. Perhaps, like reason for the postmodernist, the idea of universal human rights just collapses without a theistic basis. Now, that's certainly the Lockean, the American view. The other way out of this conundrum, either God or no human rights, is to say, well, we don't want human rights. And that's, I think, part of the challenge. But just reflect how the notion of human rights are so built into the structure of our law and our society at the moment. If we say we're no longer going to bother about human rights, that changes a very great deal very quickly. Because the whole tendency over the last, well, I suppose starting since the war with the UN Declaration of Human Rights, is to stress the notion of human rights more and more, and it's become a very, very powerful political and rhetorical tool, and indeed very often a beneficial one if you're facing down totalitarian governments. It certainly has had a powerful influence in breaking down communism in Eastern Europe, and no doubt It's a slogan, a piece of rhetoric that has its influence in the Middle East at the moment. But what do human rights depend on? Again, there is this continuing issue. Now, remember where we started out from, that I was really suggesting that human rights are very often being opposed to religion. What I'm suggesting is that human rights can't trump religion because they need religion. They don't make much sense without a religious basis. I wouldn't go so far as to say a specifically Christian one. It may be that you can have, as Jefferson indeed did, a more general theistic view. Indeed, at the start of the French Revolution, they were still talking in vaguely theistic terms to ground rights, but they soon forgot that. But there's no doubt that in Europe, we do have still a Christian heritage, much contested, much fought over, but it explains a lot of our thinking about rights. Take that away, have rights floating free, how therefore do we go on to sustain that? Can we indeed sustain our ideas of right? I've also suggested that we can't actually sustain notions of reason. Now, reason is above all the Enlightenment category. It was the category of the 17th century Enlightenment, grounding it in God. It was the category of the 18th century Enlightenment, seeing it as an emancipatory mechanism from religion. But in more recent years, postmodernists have reacted against that and wanted to revert to notions of different traditions and scorned the notion of an all-embracing reason. So, if you want to defend the notion of reason, as somebody like Nietzsche did not, you then have to think, what is it based on? We can't just assume the notion of rationality. Perhaps the same thing applies to rights. If we want to continue talking about rights, we need to assume a religious basis. So human rights can't be opposed to religion, they need it. And if you don't want human rights, you have to look elsewhere for your morality. Right, thank you.
Thank you very much, Roger. Okay, we have time for questions. Question?
Thank you for that. It's a very, very interesting, stimulating talk. I feel that... I should perhaps say that, you know, I'm a complete layperson when it comes to this. I'm not a philosopher, and I've got no... So I might be about to embarrass myself, but I'm in a very naive position. But it just strikes me, it seems to me, that although I wouldn't deny for a second, and I don't think any, well, I'm sure some people would, but I don't think any reasonable person could really deny that, as you've said, religion, and particularly Christianity, has played a central role, or, you know, it underpins, you know, human rights as we know it, as we know them. But at the same time, I'm not convinced that religion is necessary. In other, or to put it another way, and I certainly can't prove this, but I have a feeling that it is possibly the case that there is some sort of natural morality which in some way perhaps is innate, that perhaps human beings would have a conscience even if religion had never existed. I'm not sure if I'm making any sense.
Someone could probably help me out. But that is a doctrine of natural law, which of course has always asserted that we do have a natural view of religion, and even Catholics stand by the notion of natural law, part of the attraction of it for them is that it provides a platform in which they can talk to people who aren't religious about matters of common ethical concern.
Right.
And they would say, you can see that this is good or bad, independently of an appeal to God.
Right.
So I think that you certainly have something going. We might intuitively see that, yes, people shouldn't be treated like that, for instance,
but
that people have their rights. But I would say then, from a philosophical point of view, you have to go on to say, well, what grounds that?
Mm.
And I wonder if you don't almost get towards an ethical argument for the existence of God, that if the only thing that could ground that is God, and yet you feel very strongly that's right,
isn't that an argument that there must be a God to sustain that?
Well, that's a view that some people have put forward in the past. I mean, it's an a personal position. But what you're putting forward is just a view of natural law. And, of course, people who haven't been theistic have still stood by notions of natural law and notions of conscience, and that people do have a natural view of morality. It's more difficult... from a scientific point of view, if you're talking about the evolution of morality, it's very difficult to match that with a notion of rights. So a natural law view isn't something that I think you can put together with modern scientific views about, or theories about.
But could that not perhaps be just because we're, you know, despite all the advances, we're still very ignorant of our own psychology in many ways? I mean, there could arguably be some sort of innate psychological basis, which is presumably evolved over many, many thousands of years. There could be something in us that...
One of the points about recognition of rights is, I suppose, that I have to recognise the importance of other people regardless of what I need and regardless of my interests. Questions about evolution always rather stumble at that point, because particularly if you're thinking in terms of individual selection, the answer must always be, well, how is it in my genetic interests to bother about the rights of some people?
Sure. I mean, there are
big issues. Need to move on.
Yes.
I mean, we're getting a bit far afield.
I'm a lawyer, sort of a human rights lawyer for that matter. So,
oh, good.
So I'm gonna take it into a slightly different direction.
Right.
From the previous question, I think there's an important distinction sort of comes out of your discussion of the United States and also the Laozi case, European Court of Human Rights, which should be flagged up. And I think
the Laozi case is the crucifix.
The case,
that's the one about the Italian crucifix.
I mean, you've rightly mentioned the First Amendment and the part of the First Amendment that talks about the free exercise clause, the idea that the individuals have a right to profess their religion. But that amendment has a second half, which talks about the establishment clause, which is the idea that the state is not going to establish a religion. And I think this is key, and it's also key to understanding the Italian case and perhaps the case in Ireland, because... you're right to say that in the United States there's tolerance of religion, and religion is not considered to be a force for evil, perhaps even the opposite. But to an extent, the reason for that is that religion as such is considered all right, but not a particular religion and not a state religion that is an official religion. And that distinguishes the United States from... this country, which has the Church of England as the official religion, and also other European countries. And so I think one of the ways to understand the reactions to crucifixes in Italian schools and perhaps to various teachings in Catholic schools is the idea that the state is involved directly with these institutions. So whereas in the United States, nobody would intervene in the teaching of a Catholic school, but the Catholic school not receive public funding. Here, and in Italy, we were talking about a school that is funded by the Italian state, and the same would go to Ireland. So I think the reaction in Europe, the way I read the reaction in Europe, is to the idea that a particular religion is affiliated with the state, and so that religion is then subjected to other human rights criteria, such as equality, whereas if the state was neutral, so as to say, about different religions, then you would mind less what those religions do within their quote unquote private sphere. That's my reading. It doesn't necessarily negate yours, I think.
Of course, in the United States, what you're saying is true but much contested. And I mean, the whole issue about the establishment clause and how far it rules out religion as opposed to not establishing a particular denomination is still very contested. I mean, undoubtedly, historically, what that clause meant was you can't establish the Church of England on a federal basis, or you can't establish the Congregational Church from Massachusetts on a federal basis, because they were different. It didn't stop the establishment straight away in states. But I think there was the trouble was that culturally there was still a general view that the Protestant, specifically Protestant religion at that time, was accepted by everybody. But it's just that we were not going to say we're Methodist or Anglican. And now more recently, this has been challenged by people who don't want the state to, or the federal government or any part of the US government, to sign up to anything religious at all. And then therefore you get big cases about should the Pledge of Allegiance say under God, should Corey say in God we trust. I mean, when you actually look at it, the whole of American society is shot through with theistic assumptions. And so that this, although no particular denomination is thought to have any rights to lord it over others, there's still a contest, and this is at the root of the so-called culture wars, there's still it's still much contested how far there is a general theistic umbrella. And so your interpretation of the establishment clause applying neutrality is one that I think the Supreme Court has tended to be taking in recent years, but it's still much contested. And it isn't, I mean, in a way the Supreme Court themselves backed down from it because that they allow things like One Nation Under God in the Pledge of Allegiance.
Just a quick follow-up, but do you not think there's a difference between one nation under God and having a particular church as the church of the state?
Well, yeah, but that's my point. In America, they certainly are against that. So they don't want an established church as it was established in Virginia. But one nation under God is rather the same as the crucifix hanging on the wall, I think, in a way. That's the allegation. And some people in America don't like it, and other people fiercely do. Another issue is, of course, prayer in schools, which is much more contested. And prayer in American schools is outlawed. That doesn't stop schools in Virginia having a minute of meditation in the morning, which is strictly illegal, but they do it. And it just shows how feelings run high.
Okay, Brunello.
Thank you, Professor. I'm Brunello. I'm academic in history. You are here. And I'm from Brazil, and I'm
yes.
a lawyer, and
yes.
I'm agnostic.
Yes,
it's a huge problem. So, my question is about culture, religion, and pluralism.
Mm-hmm.
So I live in Brazil, which is very complex in terms of religion, mainly Catholic Church religion. But you have some minority religions that came from Catholic religion. I'll give two examples. The Santo Daime religion from the people who lives in the rainforest. They use hallucinogenous herbs to practice the religion. Okay? And drugs are prohibited in Brazil. And the African Brazilian religions, which use animal sacrifice in their rituals. So there is a huge impact in public sphere and violations of law in the practical and the rituals of those religions. What should we do in those cases?
So your question is, just repeat it.
Those kinds of religions
okay.
make violations of law in public sphere.
And that there are no exceptions or there's no accommodation for that?
No.
No. Well, what happens to them? Are they taken to the courts?
There's some kind of, they are tolerated by the law.
I mean, this is not unlike what happens in other countries. I mean, in the United States, for instance, there was a case of people using peyote, which is an illegal drug, and then the question was, should they be allowed to as part of their religious ceremonies? Perhaps near home, in prohibition times in the United States, there was the question of the use of alcohol in, say, Catholic Mass, which was allowed, I think. So I think in these cases that there's always a question as to how far you should accommodate. I mean, my inclination is to accommodate religious people as far as you can. But there are going to be lines. I mean, if one of the religions believes in sacrificing virgins at the time of the new moon, I'm not going to say, well, that's their religion, let them go get on with it. Animal sacrifices then are a bit near the edge, aren't they? Because people might be uncomfortable about quite what that involves. So there are going to be very tricky cases about drawing the line there, I think. And you've raised issues which are, I think, I mean, there is a question how far one should tolerate these things.
Yes, that's a
problem. I mean, I think, and I think if we're a tolerant country, I think the assumption would be we do, but there will always be a line, and it's going to be a matter of case-by-case examinations to how far we can accommodate without going against really important principles. I mean, animal suffering, for instance.
But it's a matter of degree, what you should tolerate, what you should not tolerate.
Well, it's bound to be, in a sense, isn't it? Yes. I think that's good. That's bound to be the case. Which it goes back to what I was saying about the way in which the European Convention on Human Rights is written, that Clause 2B says that there is a qualification built in to do with public order and morality, etc. And it can be, I think, a bit wide, and it can give the state too much control. So it is slightly worrying, but that you can't allow everything that's done in the name of religion is obviously right. And I mean, I think that you can never allow rights to be absolute in all cases, because there are always going to be counterexamples, I think. Not least when there's a clash of rights. Yes?
Hi.
I had a question related to grounding and looking for your comment on divine command. So I wasn't quite sure that you couldn't necessarily ground some of these ideas of rights in a utilitarian or consequentialist sort of framework, because you said things like liberty and equality would collapse without a theistic basis. And it seemed to me that if you're utilitarian or consequentialist, you could easily say that, you know, equality doesn't have to be based on in the sight of God, but rather equality based on rationality and self-awareness, that we should treat equal things equally, and that's just, and so you can set up this sort of framework of equality, or that we want freedom because displeasure and pain is bad, and we can see that to rob people of freedom, you know, that it would lead to displeasure in life and so on and so forth. You could frame it that way rather than saying, okay, here's a natural law, natural order of human goods. We say here's life, knowledge, and religion, or really there's something meaningful beyond the material world from which it seems like you're trying to derive rights. So that's the first thing I wanted you to comment on. And then secondly, what happens when you move beyond these sort of natural laws or natural orders to a divine command, and there's a quote-unquote suspension of the ethical or the established moral law, or I could put it this way, should Abraham be prosecuted for attempted murder?
Well, I mean, in a sense, the Abrahamic example goes back to what you're saying. In a sense, I would say yes, but because he's going beyond what we would accept as just because a religion says you've got to sacrifice your son doesn't mean the state must allow it. So I mean, from just a modern point of view, I mean, that's always a kind of tricky case, but one can, I mean, find it very hard to believe that God, if there is a God, would have commanded such a thing. But still, I don't think one could allow that. The previous thing, of course, equality lies at the root of utilitarianism, really, and everyone counts as one. I mean, in a sense, that's at the start. But you've still got the question, why, and who is everyone? I mean, one of the great problems about utilitarianism is, in fact, I think, where do you draw the line? I mean, we aren't just talking about humans. We're presumably then talking about sentient creatures. It's going to be very difficult to say humans matter. Indeed, utilitarians characteristically would gibbet that, because they would talk about human capacities much more, and human capacities being stultified, but then what about apparent humans who haven't got those capacities? Now, a human rights approach would treat people very differently, I think, or some people, than a utilitarian approach would. I mean, as classically, Singer allows infanticide. Well, that wouldn't be allowed on a human rights approach, obviously, because the infant is human. So there is going to be a difference there. And one of the issues is, well, why do humans matter? And I think that's a very important question. And it's surprising, the number of philosophers who do assume that humans matter without being able to say why. I always remember Derrida talking about human rights, and yet he didn't believe in the essence of being human, and I asked him, well, how did he balance the one against the other? And I remember he said this was in the context of a lecture, and he said, well, he didn't have time to answer that question, and I'm sure he didn't, but because it's a big issue. for him. I mean, it's difficult to draw lines around humanity. And yet, once you talk about human rights, as opposed to the rights of whoever, animals or whatever, then you've got a problem, I think.
Okay, Oliver.
I have a challenge for your view. I would accuse it of being a little Western-centered in the sense that whenever you mention religion, you actually mean Christianity. And now, on the other hand,
perhaps monotheism is kinder. I mean, I was talking about Europe, but I was. I mean, Jefferson wasn't perhaps specifically a Christian; he was a Unitarian, I think. But I mean, let's just say monotheism. But that's still restrictive, isn't it?
Well, so I would want, like, for a framework, moral framework, as human rights definitely are, I would want to have as many people on board as possible, and I want it to be universally applicable.
Right. Yeah.
So I wonder, how would you, face an Inuit or an Aborigine telling him, well, you're actually, you're the subject of human dignity because people in Europe tend to believe in a Christian God. So I wonder whether these kind of historical roots are actually, helpful in that sense.
Yes. Well, of course, that's a very good question, because it was the question faced by the United Nations after the Second World War, because you'll find that there is language in the United Nations Declaration of Human Rights that seems vaguely religious, but they never actually bring in God or anything religious. And quite clearly the reason for that is they want as many people on board as possible. They don't want to nail it down even to monotheism. They're well aware there are people of many religions and none who they want to support the nation. And this goes back to your point, that perhaps they're hoping that there is a kind of intrinsic reaction in human beings, a kind of awakening of conscience that just sees that these things are so, and that people do matter. And obviously, particularly from a political point of view, that's very important. We still have the question why they matter, what the question of justification is. And I think you've put your finger on the reason why so many people are reluctant to get into the question of justification of human rights, because it will be divisive. Because once you justify, in particularly in metaphysical terms, it will be in terms that some people won't share. So it's best to leave it all vague. Or another way is genuinely to think that there are alternative justifications converging, so that there are different views, different religions, that have their own justifications that still actually agree on the importance of human rights. But that might be optimistic, I don't know. So you've got a good problem, but then, I mean, whenever we're talking about things that are true, there are always going to be people who disagree. And the question is the issue of truth and the question of justification. I mean, what we can't do is to say, well, not everyone will agree with our justification, therefore we can't justify it, because that's even in a worse position, I think.
Very good question,
isn't
it?
Yes, thank you. Supposing somebody came along and they know very little about morals, they know very little about religion, and they ask you, they want to learn about human rights, and you give them a copy of the Bible and you say, go and read that, they'll come back very confused, because in reading the Bible, they see lots of contradictory ideas in the Old Testament and the New Testament. There'd be the vengeful parts, an eye for an eye, there'd be the forgiving parts, love your enemy. There'll be places with equality, there'll be places where slavery seems to be okay. So if you take that as being the word of God, that's where your human rights come from. There still needs to be a lot of human kind of thought and reasoning to filter out the good bits and leave behind the bad bits. So who actually decides which parts of the Bible, which parts to take for us to use as human rights? If you're saying that rights ultimately come from God, they come through the Bible.
Because I never mentioned the Bible, I just talked about God.
But that is our only kind of connection with the Word of God, presumably. I think that's what Christians believe. So who decides which parts to take?
I mean, if we're going to get a bit theological for a moment, I think in the Church of England they've traditionally said that the Bible is important, the tradition of the Church is important, and human reason is important, and one would hope they would converge. But they're each of independent value. And I use that phrase, reason is the candle of the Lord. In other words, that the Lord is somehow the root of reason. I mean, it may be a glimmering, imperfect reason, but nevertheless, reason is grounded in God. So we can use our reason. I mean, if you talk about the Bible, of course, the phrase that obviously fuels a lot of this talk is just that humans are made in the image of God. and that what is man that thou art mindful of him that has made him a little of the earth and the angels, as the psalm says. I mean, there are lots of points that talk about the precious nature of human beings. So that would be it. Now, I mean, when you work out the ethical side of it, of course, and then how this works out in slavery and so on, and so that's another issue. But I think you can see there is a tradition coming out of that we can use our reason to look at. But I mean, I've never thought you can just open the Bible and pick a verse and say, well, that's it then, that's what it says, because you need your reason to interpret the verse.
Right, okay. So the Bible acts as a kind of catalyst for our reason, kind of.
I mean, it's one vehicle, you might say. The kind of people who say only the... I mean, that's the Islamic view, that the Quran is the inspired word of God, and that you've got to just go by the text and that's it. Now, Christian theology, we don't want to get too much in Christian theology here now, but I mean, for instance, we'd emphasize the working of the Holy Spirit, which is independent necessarily. I mean, it's perhaps behind the writing of the New Testament, you might say, but also selective. Yeah.
Okay, I have a question for Matthew.
I wanted to follow up on what you're saying, and that it seems like this is not just Western in viewpoint, but also male centered. Because so much like even Christianity, so many rights of women, you know, women don't have the same rights in the church as far as like being ordained in the Catholic Church and a lot of the Christian wedding ceremonies, the wife has to obey and serve the husband, be his handmaiden. There's a lot of that. So what are your comments on that? It seems like that's one reason why people want to be protected from religion, is the male dominance of so many religions.
Yes, well, that's obviously the kind of dead weight of tradition, and sometimes the church perhaps has found it hard to keep pace with rapid social change, not all of which, of course, the church would want to agree with, I suppose. I mean, the issue about human rights is that they are human rights. We're talking about humans, we're not talking about males. And there's plenty of Christianity to suggest that males and females are equal. In Christ, there's neither Jew nor Greek, one nor free, male nor female. So I think the human rights did distress the fact that it's being human that's the category. So that I would have ought to answer your on that. So if you really feel... That women are somehow being treated as less than human, that's itself open to criticism, and that's something wrong.
Well, less than males.
Yes, but then if they're less than male, I mean, if male and female are equally human and equally important, then the one shouldn't be more important than the other. That just follows.
Right, it shouldn't be.
Yeah, well, that's part of the doctrine of human rights, you know, but I've also thought it's built in. But how that works out in practice is another matter. I mean, males and females aren't the same, so all kinds of practical issues, obviously. But where, of course, it comes particularly nowadays is that when you're up against it isn't so much the Catholic Church, it's Islam. And you'll find that, I mean, at the moment, there's a bill being introduced into some law about Sharia law, because there's a great worry that Sharia courts are operating in this country in ways that are very detrimental to the interests of women. And the bill now being introduced in the House of Lords, which has the support of both religious and non-religious, anti-religious people, is trying to say that Sharia courts can't override the law of this country, and that the position of women must be protected. So from that point of view, I mean, there are obviously religious influences that can be extremely worrying, and you know, that women can really be downtrodden. I think that comes up particularly there.
I have a question
yes.
for you, Roger, and this is a little bit out of left. So, in addition to people who emphasize human rights. There is a small group of people who emphasize the idea of extending rights beyond humans, and there's sort of been legal steps taken in this direction, I think in Spain and also in New Zealand, to try and extend rights to great apes. Don't ask me to tell you exactly which ones, but you know, I think chimpanzees certainly, and maybe some other ones. Now, I've never really understood this. I mean, I can understand, say, when Peter Singer wants to expand the circle of morality, it makes a kind of sense.
Because he's talking about things like suffering there. And it's obvious that animals suffer.
He's a utilitarian. Yes. But I just flat out don't understand why, how you can sort of go from human rights to these other sorts of rights. So I wondered if there's anything you could think of possibly in the religious tradition that could explain this.
No, but obviously they're going on capacities, and they would want to try and say that the higher apes share some important human capacities and can even reason and in some ways. But you've still got to draw the line. They may want to draw the line a little bit lower down. I mean, some higher apes are more intelligent and more capable than some humans suffering from, say, Alzheimer's. Now, so there's a question where you draw the line. And a lot of people would say, well, being human is morally irrelevant. It isn't the capacity. And now the question is, why is that? And I think that's where religious notions of human life being sacred do draw a line. And have traditionally drawn a line. Once you do away with that, I can quite see if you're beginning to think in terms of capacities, then you might rule out some humans and bring in some non-humans. I can quite see that follows.
Right, so it's a two-step move then, reduce human rights to human capacities and then see whether similar capacities are present in other species.
Yes, I mean, and obviously a lot of moral philosophers do want to take the step to emphasise capacities.
Yeah,
rather than just mere status, merely being a human vegetable in a hospital, being in a vegetative state, for some people would still involve a moral status. But for others, they'd say, well, look, that can't be as important as, say, that chimpanzee.
Yeah, that's very helpful. And we have a question over here.
Yes. It seemed to me that you were equating a religion with some kind of theist idea. Now,
I admit that for the sake of the paper, I was talking about monotheism. I admit that.
I am an East Coast American.
Yeah.
One of those. And I went to school until the time I went away to college. I went to a private school, which was run by a religious sect, but it was an atheistic religious sect.
Right.
And a lot of the equating that you did, I don't really...
Well, this gets back to the question of what is religion. And of course, there are many institutions or bodies I would accept as being religious that would be beyond the scope of what I was talking about, Buddhism, for instance, Hinduism, and so on. And I was particularly starting from the point of view of Europe and the United States, where if not solely Christianity, but at least monotheism in the Judeo-Christian tradition.
But this is an established church, established religion in the U.S.
Well, what's an established religion?
The people that ran my school.
I'm not established in the text.
No,
it was
recognized
as a religion. Even though, yes. Well, I mean, this goes back to, I find courts are very reluctant to face the question, what is a religion? Because it gets us into all kinds of minefields. When I was talking about religion tonight, I was restricting it to monotheism, and probably all too often I was actually talking about Christianity. And because I think that's where historically the root of human rights lie. Now the question is, take that away, can you still believe in human rights? That's just an issue. But I mean, I fully accept that your example is a salutary one. Yes.
Okay, now, is that another question?
Yeah,
So Brunello had a point, so we might just make these quick because...
Yes, very quick.
Yeah.
Professor, my question has much to do with those thoughts. The freedom of religions is based on autonomy. And why can't we construct in the public sphere based on autonomy the human rights? They would have the same basis and non-metaphysical basis for human rights. So we can include Inuits, atheists, monotheists, and even chimps if they got some cognition improvement. Don't you think democracy and autonomy are the real basis for human rights?
Yeah, but what do you mean by autonomy and why does it matter? Why is autonomy important?
I think it's the basis. I can choose what laws apply to me and to others.
Yes. But, I mean, but why should that matter to us? Why should I bother what you choose? Why should I respect it? I mean, this is the question. Why does freedom matter? Why do other people's freedom matter? Now, I agree it's at the basis of human rights, and I think it's tremendously important. But I still feel that this question, I mean, one traditional way of answering that has been that freedom matters because God has given us free will, and that therefore it's a God-given gift and we must respect. I mean, this in a sense was what Locke was saying, and why the magistrate shouldn't interfere with people's actions, because that was their responsibility was to God, not to the state, and we must respect that freedom. But without that, all right, I'm free. Why can't I impose my will on you? Why should you matter? I think there's still a question there. Why other people matter so much, I must, in a sense, restrict myself so that I don't, so I do respect them, just as I hope they respect me.
Okay, we might just make this the last.
Yeah, I'm going to make it very quick. I just want to press a bit on the point you were making, sort of from being sent in Islam. There's an attachment to the scripture, and you agreed that some elements of Christianity along the years had discriminatory elements, and perhaps some can still be interpreted that way. Aren't all these sort of admissions that religion today may have been the root of human rights, but today is bound by certain first principles of human rights, and the certain religious practices that don't conform with that are practices that you would not condone, even though they're done in the name of religion. So as to say, the only religious practices which you would be supportive of today, or the only religious interpretation, is the human rights compatible one.
Well, I mean, regardless of what I believe, let's just take what religious people believe. And I mean, you'll find there are a lot of religious people who would violently disagree with some of the judgments coming because of human rights. Namely, for instance, we read this in the papers almost every day, rights about homosexual practices, for instance. And a lot of people have conscience about that. Now there's no doubt about it that human rights laws and the way they're put into practice can lead to the idea that you should not discriminate, not just against sexual orientation, but against sexual practices. And there are many people who would say, I can't accept that. So there is still a conflict there, and I don't think it's as simple as to say that, human rights is dictating. I mean, and indeed, even going back to the case of women, I mean, there are plenty of religious people who would provide theological arguments for why bishops say or priests should not be female. Now, one can have a theological argument about that, but they exist, and they're not just saying, well, this is what human rights say, therefore we go along with it. I mean, it doesn't follow. I mean, there are principled reasons which one may violently disagree with, but there are principled reasons for some people for saying, well, women aren't fit for that, because I suppose, I mean, I'd say that in the Mass, the priest they were representing Christ, and somehow a woman can't do that. Now, I mean, I don't accept that, but I can see that people do. So again, rights goes one way, and I mean, genuine theology goes another in some people's cases. And I mean, it's difficult then to know what to do. I mean, we can decide who we agree with, but if we're talking about freedom of religion for a moment, I think the most important thing about freedom of religion is that you respect the actions of people you violently disagree with. It's easy to tolerate the people you agree with. It's when you think people are quite wrong. It's when you think that actually people are treating women dreadfully by saying you can't have women bishops, that the question about how far you should tolerate that does arise.